Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Dr. Christine Leo.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
And you know what? I like to think of us as the Australian triad, you know. And we'd like to welcome you to an episode of Deterrence Down Under here. Today we're going to talk about transparency, and specifically how various aspects of transparency apply to deterrence in Australia, including transparency around what is to be deterred, and transparency in terms of the tools of deterrence, like capability, credibility, communication. So this includes transparency not only to the Australian public, who you know has a right to know what's happening with national security here, but transparency to our partners and allies and those who might consider doing our nation harm. So just a reminder, the views of the host here, the three of us, the Australian triad, and the guests are their own and don't represent any institution that we may be affiliated with. So first, I'll just start us off with a couple pieces of bits of deterrence-related news ripped from the headlines here in Australia. The first one is, you know, a little bit of news that, you know, kind of made me perk up my ears, which is our podcast name, Deterrence Down Under, was the title for a recent speech delivered at the Australian Air and Space Conference by Chief of Space Operations General Chance Salty Saltzman. So, you know, I hope he's listening in here. I can't guarantee it, but, you know, it's good to see that the name is spreading wide and far. Secondly, in the news recently was a lot of news around the challenge of getting the uniformed workforce in the Australian Defence Force up. So currently there's about 58,200 uniformed personnel in the ADF, the Australian Defence Force. That's down from 60,500 in 2021. That's a loss of 4% over the past 3 years. But if you look at the requirements out there to man all these weapon systems that are going to show up and to meet all of Australia's commitments, the ADF is going to require 67,000 people by 2028. That's 15% more than today. And given that they've had a challenge attracting and retaining, there's a real challenge there. So as a result, the ADF has opened to non-Australian citizens in certain categories, specifically from Five Eyed Nations, to fill the gap. So we'll see if that has any effect, but that is a big challenge going forward for the ADF personnel. Lastly, in deterrence news, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ASPI, released a report titled Deterrence, Escalation, and Strategic Stability, Rebuilding Australia's Muscle Memory, released by Beck Shrimpton. And it details the sad state of deterrence knowledge in Australia. And probably the best sentence that kind of summarizes the findings of the document is, despite having previously been a global thought leader on nuclear weapons and deterrence half a century ago, Australia today doesn't have a strong grasp of the basics of modern deterrence. And especially concerning given that the National Defense Strategy has a large focus on deterrence in that document. And that's a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. So that leads kind of directly into our first set of discussion here, which is what does Australia need to deter and why? And how has that been made clear by recent documents? So, you know, communication of deterrence is really important, Christine, right? I mean, there are historical examples of nations having plenty of power, plenty of will, but not being clear about what they intended to deter and how that created some problems. So, you know, maybe I'll leave it to you to discuss, you know, a little bit of that.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. Beck's comments are interesting because, unfortunately, Australia has a very small strategic studies community, and so it can get political at times. And if you're not towing the party line, then you're kind of vilified. But that's okay. We're here. Deterrence Down Under, the Australian triad. For example, this goes to a question of strategic culture as well. Like, different countries have different approaches to communicating deterrence. And, you know, if you're looking at a kind of broad history of how the US has done this, like, from the get-go, the US had extended deterrence in its kind of doctrine. Like, the goal was to prevent the Soviet Union from invading Western Europe, but also obviously protecting the US homeland from Soviet attacks. But how do you communicate deterrence? And, you know, like check this out. Like, this is, the viewers can't see it, unfortunately, but like an original RAND document, like Albert, like Wohlstetter, like saying like, hey, what are the actual requirements of deterrence? And, you know, communicating, credibility, surviving a first strike, being able to launch a second strike and so forth. Initially, we had massive retaliation from the US, but very, very, you know, as RAND and other institutions created studies, it became very clear that, like, well, no, you can't just have the weapon. You have to communicate how you're going to use it and what are the logistics. And so the US kind of developed concepts of nuclear strategy, concepts of deterrence, fundamental concepts of deterrence, like second strike, damage limitation, what is reassurance? And that was not only trying to deter the Soviet Union, but reassuring allies. Like, okay, how are we actually going to use these weapons? And so the US is kind of unique, somewhat unique to that extent in sort of, it's been very, it's been quite transparent in how it communicates the use or threatened use of nuclear weapons, but also like in the financing, the acquisition. Like every year we see the National Defense Authorization Act, which details, you know, quite specifically how much we're going to spend on X capability over how many years. And that kind of holds, you know, contractors, as you said, and companies to hold them to their feet, hold fire to their feet. But the US is quite unique in that sense. And it goes to a broader question, like, could other countries extend deterrence? Because the US has been the only country to really kind of do that. You know, recently we had Emmanuel Macron kind of saying, oh yes, France will defend Europe and Germany and so forth. Like, well, one, you're not a superpower. Two, you're not a superpower, but if you're going to do that, explain to me how you're going to extend deterrence. Because it's not, again, it's, you have nuclear weapons, okay, but what are you going to do? Like, and there's this great, I had a great professor at ANU, Ron Huskin. He kind of explained this concept of like a spectrum of extended deterrence posturing. So you kind of, it goes from like the minimalist kind of implicit declaratory assurances of extended deterrence, explicit declaratory assurances, then you deploy conventional forces in the vicinity of the recipient, then you deploy conventional forces on the recipient territory, and then you deploy nuclear and conventional forces in the recipient territory to kind of reassure that country. But it's interesting how transparent the US has been in its deterrence posturing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely in nuclear deterrence, there has been a lot of transparency. Conventional deterrence, I mean, you can look at, you know, Iraq's invasion of Kuwait as potentially being a case where the United States had plenty of credibility, had, you know, plenty of capability to evict, you know, Iraq even after the invasion, but wasn't very clear in its communication that it cared about Kuwait. And there were some miscommunications, I think, that have been historically documented showing that this is a communication failure rather than a failure of the other three parts needed for, you know, deterrence on the conventional side. And deterrence on the conventional side is more difficult, let's face it, than nuclear deterrence, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the history of conventional deterrence, like, so John Mearsheimer, I'm going to quote a classic, he wrote a great book on how, on the challenges of conventional deterrence, and he looked at, you know, several historical examples. But he used mainly Western European examples, and I think it's really interesting. Like, we're going to face some serious challenges in the Asia-Pacific, because conventional deterrence hasn't really been a concept or not nearly as developed in our region as it has in Western Europe. And like, just like, what are the logistical challenges of power projection for the US in the Asia Pacific? Like fuel, ammunition, resupply. By the way, again, I've said this before and Bob Peters said this before, like the KCs, like you can't kick ass without gas.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I mean, there's also, you know, the US and its deterrence around China and Taiwan. So the United States has a long-standing policy of ambiguity on that topic as to whether they will, whether and when they will step in. They're very clear that, you know, they want to keep the status quo, That would be the preferred outcome. They're clear that, you know, any independent moves by either side to change the status quo by force are unacceptable. But I think that that's one of the more interesting deterrence cases where there isn't a lot of, you know, definitive policy that's out there that says this happens, that is unacceptable, then we will do this, as you would potentially see in a classic deterrence case like nuclear deterrence. So, I mean, Natalie, you might have some thoughts on this.
Going back to the original question of, you know, deterrence, I'd like to throw this one back to you, Carl. What is it that we're actually trying to deter? And do you think that's clear in our national defense strategy? You know, are we deterring a nuclear strike on our territory? Are we deterring encroachment of an A2D2 bubble from the second island change closer towards Australia? Are we deterring Five Eyes being blinded? Are we deterring a biological or chemical or cyber attack, a regional war or a world war? I'm still not quite sure. But then going back to the Taiwan question, I mean, and I did raise this point with Hugh White, was when he wrote his article on Are We Sleepwalking to War? And I know that you're disagreeing with me on this point, Carl, but I think Australia has an opportunity to decide whether or not it wants to contribute to US strategic ambiguity on deterrence. And the more actors that we have in that space, potentially that complicates our adversary's decision making. So when you've got, you know, if you complicate that fact with the Japan, the South Korea piece, Australia, perhaps even India, what does that problem then look like? And then, you know, China then has to think about its other targets. So I think that Australia needs to ask itself some hard questions. You know, is it prepared to actually come across as in, hey, yeah, I'm prepared to, you know, provide that paradox, so-called question, where you come across as if credibly willing to go to war. And that is a, you know, people are scared of that. But, you know, at what point do you need to look like you're going to do that? So how do you make yourself look like that little echidna or that blue ringed octopus that's going to sit there on the bottom and with the blue rings? I don't know. But yeah, I think Australia has some questions. You know, how much can it contribute to that paradoxical nature of deterrence that it is? As in, you know, you have to look scary and you have to sound scary and you have to sound as if you're going to commit to that thing when you may not actually really want to commit to the problem.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we talk about Taiwan, and then we'll jump back to the national defense strategy and what it says in big words about deterrence. But if we think about Taiwan, and the real challenge here in Australia and in the region, actually, is that there isn't a unified bloc like NATO. Like, NATO provide unified deterrence. You know, you've got the Article 5 that says, if we're in, we're all in. And, you know, it's a different story here. Every nation has their own individual interests, even seen by, you know, Russia's war with the Ukraine. India's taken a different road than Australia, for example, in approaching that conflict and how they make friends. So, Christine, you have more to add on that, I'm sure. You know, you can talk about this for weeks and let us make us smarter. So give us some knowledge, Christine.
Thanks, Carl. No, I mean, we all bring something to the table, right? I think I might have mentioned this before. I was at a unclassified war game a few months ago, and it was really interesting, like, comparing and contrasting the Europe and Asia-Pacific regions. So I was in the Asia-Pacific region, one of the countries there, and what stood out was, like, we were trying to work with the Brits, and the Brits were... We kept trying to get meetings with the Brits during this war game, and they were like, we're like, where are the Brits? And like, oh, they're in a NATO meeting. I'm like, oh, NATO meetings, they go on for hours. Like, we need the Brits. Like, no, okay, right, we'll do it ourselves, fine, whatever. So the other countries in the region, which I won't name, we just got ahead with it. Like, we're like, oh, NATO, they're doing the hour-long meetings, like, whatever. Like, we'll just go on with it. Like, you know, like, one country was asking, oh, like, hey, Australia, can you, like, send some P8s for us? And we're like, yeah, cool, we'll do it, whatever. And we just got on with it, and we worked it out as we went through. Like, we didn't need an alliance to get stuff done. Like, we just did it.
Sometimes you just need to make things happen, even around, you know, various international frameworks and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And even in NATO, that's happened, you know, in various conflicts that NATO's fought.
It felt like Legally Blonde, like, you go to Harvard? It's like, you can do that? And it's like, uh-huh.
Good one there. So in terms of Australia and its policy of deterrence by denial, here's a quote from the National Defense Strategy. So the National Defense Strategy will see a strategy of denial become the cornerstone of defense planning. This approach aims to deter any conflict before it begins, prevent any potential adversary from succeeding in coercing Australia through force, support regional security and prosperity, and uphold a favorable regional strategic balance. So we get to that, Natalie. I mean, it sounds like we want to be all things to all people, which is always the challenge with any strategy because every strategy is limited by resources and by the capabilities of the nation who's trying to implement it. So, your thoughts on that, Christine?
I think Australia's always had an interesting space in the world, and I think it's something that our American friends might not realize to some extent. Like, the history of Australia is quite unique. Like, 1788, 1776, you throw a bunch of white people on this continent in the middle of the Asia Pacific. They do their thing, and they, you know... And so Federation in 1901, you know, all the states, the colonized states, they come together to form a federation, the Federation of Australia. But it's kind of an anomaly in world history in that you have all these white people in the middle of an Asian region. So how do these people, these new people who have overtaken indigenous land, how do they think about where they belong in this strange region full of, you know, people who are not their color and so forth. And traditionally it's unfortunately, after the Second World War, I mean, like there was this thing, I was like, oh, the communist Chinese and the communist Indonesians will come and invade our territory. It's like, well, yes, no. And that's when Australia had its nuclear weapons program to kind of like try and, how do we exist in this strange new region which is not dominated like by Western maritime power. Before it was the UK and then it was the US. How has Australia thought about its security has evolved significantly? And there's never been a direct existential, I'm emphasizing here, threat to Australia. It's always been, well, we've thought about ourselves as in contributing to, again, empire defense before the United States kind of dominated the Asia Pacific region, and then in the context of the alliance with the United States, so threats have always been kind of indirect to Australia in the sense that Australia thinks about itself in the context of global order rather than a regional order, and now that we're like China's kind of trying to, well, we can argue this, but like trying to dominate the region, it's becoming a much more regional thinking about deterrence, security, and so forth. And Australia, one, is not super familiar with this situation, and two, hasn't really had to think about it very hard. So there's a lot of things happening where Australia's like, oh, I have to think about this now. So I can understand how there has been traditionally, a lot of confusion in successive government documents, like successive white papers and so forth. And so I'm not surprised by the NDS.
Yeah. I mean, the spotlight has shifted over time, right? So if we look at the Cold War, you know, the spotlight was clearly on Europe and, you know, focused on Europe, although there were other areas of potential conflict. And then we get to, you know, the 1990s and beyond, where the focus shifted to the Middle East and conflict there. And it seems like the spotlight has just shifted. You know, now the spotlight is on the Indo-Pacific. Australia is clearly in the shine of that spotlight, and it plays a different role than it does standing outside the spotlight and trying to contribute to the global order. You know, it needs to be an active actor in terms of, you know, moving along and working with partners and actively engaging inside the region to help prevent conflict.
Yeah, it's a change in mindset for Australia, and it's interesting. Like, and how will, I think it's really, it comes back to kind of this concept of strategic identity, strategic culture, strategic personality, and how countries change over time. So it'll be really interesting. Like, and also like, if war were to erupt, heaven forbid, in the Asia Pacific, how would Australia think about itself post World War, and how do we think about, you know, the international order as we've understood it since the 90s? And I think a lot of people, it's you know, the 90s, I kind of criticized Francis Fukuyama in a previous episode, but it's kind of interesting seeing the global evolution of the mindset towards war, like Ukraine and Israel. It's like, well, yeah, unfortunately, war is a constant in humanity, and we kind of forgot that.
Yeah, exactly. The end of history has not come to pass just yet, so we are still in history.
Oh, no!
History is still being made. I mean, but that does bring us to a good point, which is, you know, this: in order to deter, you need to have credibility and capability, and you need to be somewhat transparent around your capability. In Australia, I would say, has not typically thought of this as much as other nations. Like the United States during the Cold War in testing nuclear weapons would very clearly demonstrate that this nuclear weapon worked or the delivery system worked, and it was quite effective in order to convince the adversary, don't mess with us. And I think this is a foreign concept to Australia. So, I mean, Christine, you probably have some thoughts as to why this is important and, you know why it matters historically.
Sure. So when I was a PhD student, I had the, look, yes, it was Vegas, but you know, it's not my fault. I was at this fantastic conference. CSIS has this thing called a Project on Nuclear Issues, and they bring in young scholars to come and talk. It was my first international conference, and it was so much fun. And we got to visit the Nevada test site. So we spent 6 hours on the bus looking at all these like craters, and like, it was just incredible. Like, I'm a nerd. So,
Did you wear a Geiger counter?
No, but I got to go to Vegas. So,
oh, there you go.
But I saw the Sudan test site, and it was just, it's one thing, you know, reading about stuff in books. It's another, to actually see it in real life. And it just kind of brings home, like, These are real things. And of course, like signaling, like missile signaling, it's part of communicating the credibility of your capability. And that's why North Korea tests increasingly its capabilities. It's like, well, you know, don't mess with me. I have these things, they work. It's language. And it's, I remember when I was a teenager, I watched the movie 13 Days, and it just blew my mind, and it's one of the reasons I got into history. It was the Russians and the Americans were kind of signaling with their boats and trying to get the boats out of Cuba. The boats were trying to, you know, send missiles to deploy to Cuba, and McNamara was like, no, like this is language, this is new language, and it goes to the concept of nuclear learning, which I think is underdeveloped, but really interesting. It's this idea that countries go through a phase where they try and understand, not through verbal language, but like through signaling. Oh, okay, what does that mean? That test. Oh, they're deploying here. What does that mean? And it's, I remember when I was living in Pakistan, like it was a big thing, like India and Pakistan learning their language, like with, because there was this big controversy over Pakistan's Nasser, the 60-kilometer range, quote-unquote, tactical nuclear weapon, which the Pakistanis didn't think is tactical, but the Indians did. It's like going through this whole phase of like, okay, what's tactical, what's strategic, and et cetera. But yeah, nuclear learning, nuclear signaling, it's all part of the language.
I think Australia also needs to ask itself, at what cost is it prepared to, the human cost as well. So at what human cost are we prepared to accept? I mean, people are scared of nuclear deterrence and deterrence, but when I think about the human cost to life in Ukraine and in Russia, I mean, during the pandemic, we were able to all lock down and, you know, we didn't accept a human cost more than, I don't know what the actual percentage was of our population in the end, but it could have been much higher than what it was. Australia also needs to look at that point. At what cost are we prepared to accept in that human attrition, as well in terms of what our options would be, in terms of our strategy as well.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to the challenge of deterrence is if you set a cost and some nation says, we're willing to exceed that cost and make it more painful than you for you than that number of people or whatever, it's a challenge, right? So Australia's got to be resilient to threats. That is another piece of it, is not only the government leadership and, you know, the government employees, but the general population needs to be resilient to these kind of threats and, you know, be ready, be prepared for them, which is part of why communication is so important here. Understanding the threat, what is it, what are we getting ourselves into here, and the importance of deterrence for exactly these reasons you talked about, Natalie, which is the loss of life if deterrence fails is massive. So how are we getting together as a nation to be resilient and provide a common front and a deterrent front to any potential adversary who wishes to do us harm?
Yeah, it's not quite as easy as developing medical countermeasures and or, you know, having more babies.
Exactly right. Or building houses, as many who are trying to buy a house in this country would argue. Yeah. So I think the challenge is, you know, how does Australia explain its capabilities in a way that deters, rather than, you know, having leaks that come out that say, oh, the Collins maintenance wasn't as good as we thought years after the fact. That erodes deterrence. How do we put pressure and be more clear about Australia's capability to respond in the region and be prepared should the flag go up to respond in a way that will be coordinated with its allies, if we're talking China, but, you know, in a way that contributes strongly to deterrence and, you know, keeps people interested in staying away from bothering Australia.
Well, as Jim likes to say, you know, deterring war is cheaper than waging war.
Very true. You know, war is an expensive thing. That might be a good place to kind of wrap it up. And we've got some points for discussion going forward, which is looking at how Australia is more transparent about its capability and developing that capability. How can we be more efficient here, such that, you know, we have more successful programs and less failed programs and a more efficient use of funding? Because funds are not unlimited, as many nations are finding out, including the United States, and industrial capability is not unlimited either. So how can we be most efficient with those things? So a seed for next time when we come back to this topic of transparency. Any final words, Natalie?
No, I think that was a good discussion. I still think Australia's got a lot to think about in terms of what it is, what it wants to deter and how it's going to go about that and at what cost it's prepared to do that.
Yep. Christine, last words.
I think it's really interesting, like Australia, as I said, like Australia as a country, as a nation, and how we think about ourselves. I think there's a lot of maturity that needs to develop around thinking about war, deterring war. Like I said, we haven't been at the front line. We weren't at the front line of the Cold War, for example, which was like a fundamental paradigm shift from previous eras of human conflict or non-conflict. I think Australia still has a very long way to go in developing its maturity around thinking about deterrence and conflict and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And kind of refining this idea of deterrence, how you think about deterring, it isn't just the long-range strike to impact an enemy at distance, which works well in a nuclear world where it's hard to defend. But how do you think about a balanced approach to offense and defense in a deterrence environment? Because projecting power tends to be more expensive than providing power nearby. So, you know, open questions, lots of grist for the mill for future discussions, and really appreciate everyone tuning in to Deterrence Down Under here. So just to recap, today we talked about transparency, what's to be deterred and why, capability, credibility, and communication. And next time we'll be talking more about transparency around, you know, capability and acquiring that capability and how we can best deter any potential aggressors that may wish to do us harm here in Australia. So that's about all we have time for this morning. Thanks all, and stay warm for those in Australia. For those in the Northern Hemisphere, I hope you have an air conditioner. Thanks for listening, and just remember to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies.
NIDS is a US-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of US strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.